Good evening, you listen to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the world of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights or the arts in conversation. My guest tonight is the writer Richard Wilson. Richard read philosophy at University College London and has written a book called Titanic Express. He works for a human rights organisation and lives in London. And we're going to be talking about his latest book tonight, which is called Don't Get Fooled Again, The Skeptic's Guide to Life. Richard, welcome to Little Atoms. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Good evening, Neil.
So let's talk first about why you chose to write this book. Why did you choose to write about scepticism? And I suppose why at this particular time? Is there a reason why you thought it was important now?
I think it is. I think scepticism is very much in the air at the moment. And obviously, it's not the first book that's been written on this subject, but I think that it's the defining moment for me was really the Iraq War and all the things that were said around weapons of mass destruction, which we now know not to be true. And I think that left people sort of feeling very doubtful about a lot of things. But equally, I personally, I think a lot of other people as well, are quite sick of the more outlandish conspiracy theories, which really seem to take kind of paranoia and doubt to an extreme. So it's a book that's attempting to find a kind of middle way between sort of blanket naivety on the one extreme and blanket paranoia at the other.
Well, let's go straight into that then, because the weapons of mass destruction thing, I suppose we could say, is a conspiracy theory that turned out to be true.
It depends how you want to look at it. I mean, I think that what's interesting, obviously, because so much still hasn't really been opened up in terms of the archives. I think the Americans are better at it than we are, but it's still very hard to know what exactly was being said and done when we were being told these things. You know, was it a sort of kind of problem of groupthink among the politicians who'd just so convinced themselves of this kind of picture they had in their mind that they were kind of almost auto-brainwashed, or was it something a bit more sinister? And I honestly don't know the answer to that.
I mean, this is, I'd sort of tend to err on the side that, you know, Blair, for instance, believed this, you know, rather than this was some, you know, duplicitous thing that he would, you know, the guys genuinely did believe that this would, that they were going to get out there and find stuff. Now, I suppose the interesting thing, again, we're saying this is a sort of conspiracy theory that came true. And I think what's always sort of interesting about why this would be different from, you know, what you've just described as more outlandish conspiracy theory is, well, this is something we know about.
You know, evidence is there. I mean, there's no way around it. The government's very plainly stood up and told the whole world that X was the case. And it turns out that it wasn't, and that a lot of corners had been cut at the very least in the process that went into this claim that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But the line I sort of like to take in the book is actually that if we define a conspiracy theory as a theory that someone has about a secret plan, and they're trying to convince us that there's this secret plan going on, but their evidence is very weak or perhaps even dodgy, then it's quite arguable that what the idea that the politicians fell for in 2003 was actually a conspiracy theory. It was a claim that Iraq was secretly harbouring these weapons. However much the weapons inspectors, you know, kept on reporting about that they'd found nothing, you had people like Donald Rumsfeld saying, well, you know, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, which actually is a line straight out of conspiracy theories about UFOs. That people who believe that the governments around the world are covering up the existence of UFOs. So one of the points I make in the book is really that it's not just ordinary members of the public who can fall for conspiracy theories. It's people in high office as well. And obviously the damage that can result when someone in a position of power gets sucked into delusional ideas is obviously far much greater.
Well, let's just go back a step then. Perhaps we should define what we mean by skepticism,
yes,
as a term. So, and why, you know, what is skepticism, and why is a skeptical outlook in life a useful thing to have?
Skepticism, in my view, is forming your beliefs on the basis of evidence. So it's not believing in nothing. It's not nihilism, but it's saying if you're asked to believe what a proposition, whether it's that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, or any other things I look at is the fact that we all pretty much can agree that HIV causes AIDS, whether it's a claim about science, what you're doing is you're saying, well, okay, what's the evidence for that? And where there is good evidence for something, then it's reasonable to believe it, at least provisionally. But where there's a lack of evidence, a skeptic will withhold their belief. It's useful, obviously, I think, because in situations it can be a life or death issue. You know, whether or not you form your decisions about your health on the basis of evidence, or whether you embrace some kind of superstition or sort of non-evidence-based belief, that can have a material difference to whether you live or die at the extreme. And equally, the decisions that governments make, again, you know, thousands if not millions of lives hang in the balance on these sorts of things. So it's really about how we evaluate ideas. And it's what I look at in the book is where the consequences of making mistakes are particularly damaging and dangerous.
Well, we're going to look at some of those examples more closely in a while, but there's a line in the book that really leapt out to me that I want to sort of read out, which is there's a canard that's often put to people of a rational bend that science is a modern thing, it's quite scary, it's quite, you know, it's quite unknowable. And things like religion and I suppose even, you know, various forms of alternative medicine, for instance, are ancient knowledge that has stood the test of time and these sort of things. But this is this sort of great line in the book, which is, if you'll indulge me, despite every attack on the foundations of rationality, the most basic principles of logic and evidence seem as sound today as when they were first committed to scrolls and tablets thousands of years ago. So this, you know, this very idea of you know, logic, science, reason has been with us
since the ancient Greeks, and probably before. Absolutely. And I think there's a complete artificial construction that's put together when people make those sorts of arguments. When people say, well, you have science here and logic here, and then there's alternative medicine over here, as if alternative medicine somehow exists outside. But every attempt to state that any idea has to do so on the basis of logic. You know, anyone that says, oh, but there's a contradiction in your argument there, is referring to logic. So though they may pretend not to, the people who describe themselves as alternative and traditional, or all these sort of bevy of supposedly non-rationalist views, actually they are, they all their arguments proceed on the basis of logic. It's just that often the logic seems rather flawed. And on the same way with evidence. I mean, you know, they will, you know, for example, homeopathy. They will cite cases where they say it worked, homeopathy worked for this person or that person, and then they'll say, oh, but you can't evaluate the evidence because we've got these special rules, so you can't actually evaluate them. But they're still actually tacitly accepting the idea of evidence. So all I think that science tends to do is it goes right back to the very first principles, and it just strips it down right to the very, very basic principles of logic, and then says, what can we build from there? And I think that's why it's tended to be more reliable, because there are just fewer gaps in it.
Well, we're going to come back to that point as well towards the end of the show. But let's go back now and look at some of the examples that you talk about in the book, sort of the concrete examples of ideas where, you know, the scepticism and rationalism has sort of failed the people that are coming up with these ideas. And the first one I'd like to look at is the promotion of asbestos and white asbestos.
Absolutely.
Which is not one I was particularly familiar with until I read this book, and it's interesting. A lot of you just mentioned homeopathy, for instance.
Yes.
And we can picture the person that would be defending homeopathy against the, you know, the evil big pharma, for instance.
Yes.
You know, we know that person. What we've got here is an example of the opposite, of more establishment people defending the ideas of asbestos against the
more left-wing kind of perspective. Yeah, we tend to, I know exactly what I mean, we tend to think of alternative people with a capital A as being kind of iconoclastic and sort of anti-establishment. And obviously that's a big issue. But the case that you refer to, the asbestos issue, it's a really extraordinary case study to look at, because it's largely been brought into the public eye through the work of one journalist, the Sunday Telegraph columnist Christopher Booker. And his whole ambience, the way that he presents himself is very much the language of the skeptic. He's the no-nonsense debunker. And one of the things one of the conclusions I came to when I was writing the book was that a lot of the time, some of the most bogus and dangerous ideas that we're being sort of asked to believe now are often put forward by people who present themselves very much as skeptics. And in the case of Christopher Booker, his whole idea is that White Asbestos has been cruelly demonised, which is an interesting idea where I can't like the idea of a rock being demonised.
The poor, terrible asbestos industry, cruelly
maligned by these crazy, zealous, environmentally minded people, and that basically... The upshot of what he's saying is that the science, the established science, which is accepted by pretty much the entire academic community around asbestos, that's been corrupted essentially by this cruel, panicky demonization. And Christopher Booker has all the answers. And he's actually written, I was saying, 38 articles in the Sunday Telegraph, basically all of them, as far as we can tell, flawed on making false statements about the science. It's now 39.
So since publication, there's been
since
more.
Publication, there have been several more, including... A few weeks ago, George Monbiot picked up this theme and talked about my book and the research that I'd done. And in responding to George Monbiot and attempting to rebut George Monbiot, Christopher Booker then made yet more statements about asbestos science, which I can show are absolutely wrong and false. So I think we need to be really wary of the people who present themselves as debunkers, and obviously I'll include myself in this. It's about going back to what the evidence actually says. And the defining feature of the Christopher Booker way of doing things is that he will tell you, oh, well, there was this study, for example, in 2000 by Hodgson and Darnton, and they concluded the following, essentially that white asbestos was harmless. But then you actually go back and look at the study and you read their conclusions, and that was not what they said. And essentially, it's a form of misrepresentation.
The book is quite interesting in that he's a climate change skeptic as well, for instance, and he sort of seems to have set himself up as he recently published a book, which is a number of these
a whole shopping list.
Of unusual causes to get behind,
there are certain common themes that emerge. If you list them, there's he doesn't believe that the oil industry is responsible for global warming. He doesn't believe that the asbestos industry, or that at least the white asbestos industry, is responsible for people's health problems. He doesn't believe that the smoking industry is responsible for deaths from passive smoking. He's a skeptic about passive smoking being harmful. And it is a really interesting case. And what's really striking is that he's been basically given carte blanche to keep putting this stuff out almost pretty much every week in the Sunday Telegraph in various different forms. And the health and safety executive has repeatedly rebutted him and corrected him. Academics, I've spoken to people who academics who've made efforts to straighten this out, and the Sunday Telegraph just keeps printing it because Christopher Booker has a following, and it should be said he's an eminent figure with a great reputation. And that's, I think, another clue to how some of these problems work, that somebody can build themselves up a great reputation and do a lot of I guess good work. He's obviously got this reputation from somewhere. But then once they've got themselves in that position, it's actually very difficult if things start to go wrong to tackle it. And I think that's the story with Christopher Booker.
There's two interesting points there, I think. You talk about this idea of the sort of fake expert.
Absolutely.
For a start, that you mentioned a guy called John Bridle.
Yeah, yeah.
Who, well, if you'll explain who he is.
Well, according to Christopher Booker, he's been Professor John Bridle. He's been one of the country's leading asbestos experts. He's been the country's leading practical asbestos expert. He's been a brave whistleblower. But the problem with all of this is that his professorship is an honorary professorship from a Russian institute that very few people have heard of. And not, in fact, the Russian Academy of Sciences, which is what Christopher Booker said he'd been given this honor by. As far as we can make out, he doesn't even have any A-levels in science. And Booker has endorsed his expertise on 13 or more occasions, as far as we can make out. Essentially, he's in the great tradition of Dr. Gillian McKeith and so many other people, but he's on the other side.
Well, Ben Goldacre was on last week, and I can't remember the guy's name, but Ben's got the great example of the MRSA expert, who is basically a guy in a shed somewhere doing his own experiments. But this is my point, that these characters appeal to the media in some way, don't they? And the media loves a controversy, and it loves a scare story. And if they've got one go-to guy, this John Bridle is obviously the case who they can go to and get a good quote. That's the way they operate.
Absolutely. These people are often really good with words, and they'll have clever little memorable ways of talking about it. Why is asbestos bad for your health or bad for your wealth? That's one of Bridle's slogans. And also the idea that this one brave solitary guy in his garden shed or whatever has proved all those experts wrong. I think a lot of people like that.
Yeah, that's appealing, isn't it?
It's an appealing story, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's look at another example, because I think there's some more unusual and interesting elements to this, which is the AIDS denial.
Extraordinary
thing.
Story.
I'm sure we're all familiar with AIDS denial in Africa, for instance, but you start this further back, right?
Absolutely.
Back to when, you know, AIDS was first, back in the early 80s, when it sort of first was discovered. And if you could be in my telling us the rather extraordinary story of Caspar Schmidt.
Yes, the psychologist Caspar Schmidt, back in, I think it was 1984.
And his idea where AIDS came from was?
It was triggered by a vast society-wide conservative swing to do with the appearance of Reagan in the White House. This was his theory. That was making... producing an epidemic of shame among homosexuals, and they were so ashamed of the way that they'd been made to feel by Reaganism that they started dying and their immune systems collapsed, and that was the reason that this disease was started. This was Caspar Schmidt's theory. So it was essentially mass hysteria. This was his theory, and that was in 84, and it sort of evolved in a weird way. It kind of mutated like a disease, because for a while that kind of appealed in a, it's kind of hard to figure out why that took on initially, but basically if you've got this disease and you don't understand it and all these doctors are telling you, you know, there's a very high chance that you're going to die, we can't cure you, one of the obvious ways to try and deal with that is to go into denial. And I think that was possibly where it began to start. And then in 87, I think it was, a scientist called Peter Duisberg comes along, and he's actually a virologist. Now, he doesn't deny that the HIV virus exists, but he's of the view that it's harmless. And one of his quotes is, that virus is a pussycat. And that position that he took at the time, you know, in the late 80s, you know, it seemed reasonably, you know, there were a lot of gaps still in the theory. So much was still unknown. And he got certain respectable following for that theory, but as time passed on, more and more evidence emerged showing very, very clearly that, you know, it definitely was HIV that was killing people, and more parts of the mechanism were understood and explained. And then much later on, drugs came along which actually were antiviral drugs and were seeming to bring about recoveries in patients. So the evidence just got stronger and stronger and stronger. But what happened was Duisberg continued to deny it, even however strong the evidence that came along. He resorted to this, what I call bogus skepticism, where he would just look for any reason to dismiss it. And gradually, you know, now he's essentially regarded by many people as a complete dogmatist. And another case of a very well-respected expert, I would say going off the rails slightly. And then what's interesting is that it hits the headlines in 2000. I mean, the case that everyone seems most aware of, I think, is the situation in South Africa, when Thabo Mbeki, President Mbeki, picked up these ideas and started to take them seriously. But what's less well understood is that these ideas were so convincing by 2000, because they'd been evolving and developing and building up and turning into practically an ideology for, you know, more than a decade before that.
Well, I mean, you've already slightly raised it, but I want to go over this again, which I find really interesting, because the reason I brought up Caspar Schmidt,
yes,
is that when you just say that what his belief was, and it sounds like the, you know, the rantings of some terrible, you know, right wing crazy.
Yes,
Caspar Schmidt was an AIDS sufferer.
Yes, that's the thing.
And this is repeated again and again, you know, with the various characters. And it's this interesting thing that you said, you've already mentioned, that one of the key things here might be that these guys were just in denial about the fact that they'd got an incurable disease.
Absolutely, and that was a big part of it, I think. And it's really tragic. It's horrible. You track back and you read the people who were writing about AIDS denialism in the early 90s, and some of the websites are still there, abandoned, because the people maintaining those websites have died of AIDS. And it's this weird, horrible litany. And I think some of the most tragic cases are maybe people who got into it in the early 80s, when maybe as a psychological survival strategy it made good sense. But by the time the drugs came along in the mid-90s that could have saved their lives, they were so into it that it was just psychologically too difficult to pull back. These are the people that could have perhaps, well, almost certainly would have lived much longer if they hadn't been sucked in by AIDS denial.
There's an interesting point as well that you raised, that again, we'll probably be familiar with the argument that's often used in the African case, which is that the drugs were part of, you know, some sort of Western imperialist science thing that was
a big conspiracy. Again, a big conspiracy. Yeah.
What's interesting as well is that the gay people would have been suspicious of the medical establishment in America at the time because of, you know, because the way that they had been
treated
in the past.
Yeah, I mean, so homosexuality the same sort of thing was comes still out. Regarded as a mental illness until the late 20th century in some parts of the American medical establishment. So it was definitely, there was reason to be suspicious of the medical establishment. And I think a lot of the most dangerous theories are ones where there's a kind of quite a plausible starting point. You know, these people are telling us that we've got this terrible disease because we're gay. You know, they told us stuff before that was something wrong with us, and this is one of the conclusions I came to. But it's very human to get sucked into some of these ideas. It's incredibly human, and it's incredibly difficult often to know. So I think sometimes it's very easy to demonize people for falling for bogus ideas, but everybody does all the time, actually. Human beings aren't particularly good at being rational and objective.
But it's interesting here, there's a tangible result, which is that, you know, you decide that you don't believe in this disease, it's not there, it's not real, I'm not going to take the medicine. But then suddenly people are dying around you, everybody you know starts dying, and yet it carries on. You know, people don't then go, oh, perhaps there is something in this.
It's extraordinary. And I think there's probably another 10 books to be written on the psychology of all of this, because I think that it does remind me slightly of a cult situation where I think there was a cult back in the mid 20th century where there was a prophecy that a UFO was going to come and take them all away and on a certain date, and often cults have these sorts of stories, and it didn't turn up, and you'd expect that when the UFO didn't turn up, everyone would go, show's over, okay, time to get a different ideology. But actually, they became stronger believers because they became even more entrenched and defensive, I guess. And I think there's a certain amount of that happening now with AIDS denialism. I mean, they are so passionate. I wrote an article for the New Statesman that was published about 3 weeks ago, and it triggered, it's so far now, 145 comments from people basically saying that AIDS is a big hoax. And they're still at it, probably now. They were certainly at it yesterday when I checked. It's like the more evidence piles up, the more passionate and vocal and vehement they become.
We're quickly running out of time again. It's gone ridiculously quickly. So many things I wanted to talk about that we're not getting to. But one of the things I'd really like to talk about, even if it's quite briefly, you talk about the limits of rationalism. Absolutely. I mean, you talk a lot, which we've not been able to cover, about religion, which again is, you know, a theme that we've obviously gone over a lot on the show. But let's look at, for ourselves, you know, secular rationalist atheist people, the limits of rationalism. You know, there are things that are just unknowable.
Absolutely, and with certainty, I think most things are unknowable. I mean, I think ultimately it's all provisional. You know, I think the people who really get into trouble are the people who attach themselves absolutely to one particular set of ideas and never adapt those ideas in the face of evidence. So, you know, certainly everything I've seen in this book suggests that it's so easy to be wrong. Psychology studies would suggest that most of us are mildly deluded, at least, about many things most of the time. But then philosophically, I think actually if you take the strictly rationalist approach and really try to live your life like it, it's very, very difficult, because obviously religion goes out the window, but then there are all sorts of other things like the enduring existence of the self. If you take away the immortal soul, because the body changes, you know, constantly, and it's always in this sort of state of renewal and regeneration. I mean, it's difficult to say what it is that makes me the same person I was 7 years ago, or you, or anyone else. And in equally free will, I don't know how you figure out free will, really. And, you know, I studied this for years at the university. If we live, you know, if we're looking at it from a materialistic point of view, and I think part of being a human being actually is, but perhaps that we have to just live in a little bit of a bubble just to kind of have a normal life.
I'm just in the middle of reading Marcus Chown, the science writer's book about quantum mechanics. He's going to be on the show in November. And there's just, you know, a number of facts on the back cover. One of them is, you know, this idea that all of matter is basically empty space. You know, so a molecule is you know, incredibly high percentage of empty space. And it gives this fact that, bearing that in mind, the actual real volume of all human beings on the planet, taking away the empty space, could fit into the size of a sugar cube. Now, how you then...
How do you get your head around that?
How do you adapt that into the, you know, into the life that you're living, the fact that everything that we're looking around is, you know, is just empty space.
And that's the thing, if we are these kind of essentially clever chimpanzees, who evolved primarily to be hunter-gatherers and, you know, running after woolly mammoths. Why should we suppose that we'd be particularly well equipped to deal with facts like that, to deal with those sorts of realities? I really think it's true that it's impossible to live a life without delusion. We just have to make sure that we live as much as we can without the delusions that are going to kill us.
I think that's a perfect time to end. I mean, we could have gone on for ages, but that's a great point to end on. So, Richard, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, it's been
tonight.
A pleasure.